Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Billboard on Broadway podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Milzoff, features editor at Billboard and Broadway expert here. So over the past year, the new musical Be More Chill has swiftly become one of my favorite topics. If you listen to the podcast, well, hopefully you are at least somewhat intrigued by it, too, because I have had its composer, Joe Iconis, on before, and I also covered the show in its off-Broadway run last summer with guests Jason Tam, Will Roland, and Stephanie Hsu. So I'll keep my summary of it pretty brief. I do want to let those of you who have never heard of Be More Chill get an idea of what it's about. The basics are Be More Chill is the story of a high school student, Jeremy Heer, who, in an effort to become more cool and win the affections of the girl he has a crush on, takes a pill-sized supercomputer called a Squip that gives him the confidence to, as the title of the show says, be more chill. Obviously, things do not go perfectly after that, but you'll have to see the show to find out how. Be More Chill started its life in 2015 at a theater in New Jersey where it got middling reviews, seemed like it would begin and end there. But over the next year and a half, it became clear that the show had a passionate following, and thanks really to the internet, fan art, videos, and more, it became this kind of viral sensation, and buoyed by that support, made it to a sold-out major off-Broadway run. And now it's on Broadway, coincidentally, in the theater right next to Billboard's office. So I can confidently say its crazy fan following has only grown. I have the pleasure of wading through all of them every day when I leave the office. So for anyone who saw the show off-Broadway, you won't notice any glaring differences on Broadway. But it does feel to me like the performances and the production itself have kind of subtly shifted to fill out a bigger theater and to play to a bigger audience. The best parts of the show, I think, only shine brighter than they did before, including Iconis' incredibly catchy score, this sort of gung-ho, we're all in it together ensemble feel of the show. Despite the fact that Jeremy is the main character, everybody is really a star at some point. And just the joy of seeing truly one of the most diverse casts in a Broadway show, just being themselves and having fun on stage every night. We talked about this latest step in the Be More Chill journey and so much more. Be More Chill cast members, I think, are some of the most fun Billboard on Broadway podcast guests ever on this week's episode with return guest, perhaps it should be said, Hall of Fame guest, Stephanie Hsu, George Salazar, who plays Jeremy's best friend, Michael, and sings the big central anthem of the show, Michael in the Bathroom, and Gerard Canonico, who plays Rich, the character who fatefully tells Jeremy about the Squip in the first place.
Just Michael in the bathroom, Michael in the bathroom at a party. Forget how long it's been. I'm just Michael in the bathroom, Michael in the bathroom at a party. No, you can't come in. I'm waiting it out till it's time to leave.
My name is George Salazar, and I play Michael Mel in Be More Chill.
I'm Gerard Canonico, and I play Rich Garansky in Be More Chill.
Also, yay.
Yay. Yay. And I'm Stephanie Hsu, and I play Christine Canigula in Be More Chill, the Broadway musical.
Yeah.
Ew, you guys.
It's a podcast, George.
It's like an ASMR podcast.
Yes, just make as many guttural noises as you like to. I have done a Fiddler on the Roof in Yiddish podcast, so you have to live up to guttural noises that were made on that podcast.
All right, challenge accepted.
Yeah. Yes, there was a lot of, so you can choose your noise.
Cool.
Okay.
Okay. Well, this is like maybe a podcast record. It seems that if there's ever an opportunity to have people in Be More Chill or related to Be More Chill on this podcast, I just snap it up.
Appreciate that.
Yes, I've had a for podcast listeners who are new, there is a Joe Iconis cast that you can listen to. There is an off-Broadway Be More Chill cast you can listen to, and now there's this one. But I would say that the first Be More Chill podcast, which Stephanie was a guest on, I think is a Hall of Fame one for us, and I think that Stephanie is a Hall of Fame guest. There were a lot of people. a lot of people were fans after hearing you on that one. So we're going to have to return to some of that subject matter.
Okay.
Yes, it will remain mysterious for the moment.
Okay.
We're just going to say okay for the whole podcast. So exciting news is that we're neighbors now.
We're neighbors.
Yeah. Yes. What a fun commute.
The Be More Chill Theater, the Lyceum, is conveniently located directly next to the Billboard offices. So this means that every day when I leave work, I get to like wade through a giant line of very excited Latines.
Sorry.
I go to work. And the first time it happened when you guys first opened, I was like, who are these people? Is this like for Planet Hollywood, which is also next door to us?
Yeah, those lines sort of get interweaved sometimes on that block. It gets a little insane on 45th Street these days.
People who want to just like go eat some
Hollywood.
Overpriced wings are like, wait, where am I?
You know, that good quality New York food.
Yes, but it's like so exciting to like see everybody taking selfies with the sign. It's like it's a real kind of like enduring hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
100%. It kind of in some ways reminds me of Rent. We talked about this at the Jonathan Larson Project podcast, but yeah, it feels really cool to be a part of something like that.
It's just crazy to see it too. Like I always tell this story. It's one thing to see like the numbers on my phone sort of increase and like followers increase than to actually see the people with my eyes. It's like a totally different experience and still overwhelms me like to this day.
Well, it's like it's so interesting to me because there are certainly shows in recent memories who have like very big fan bases like Hamilton and Dear Evan Hansen. But like it feels like there are real Be More Chill stands. Like it's kind of on another level. And it's funny that you mentioned Rent, George, because like the night that I went to see it on Broadway, like there were so many people who like wear the Creeps shirt in the audience and, you know, like have the merch and just really seem like fans on a different level. And I was trying to think of any show that reminded me of that. And I have to, you know, I didn't get to see Rent on Broadway when it opened, but I have to imagine that it's similar to the way the Rent heads were. And it's kind of interesting to witness that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's also a beautiful phenomenon. We actually had a tour of the Schubert Archives last week, and to be able to be inside one of the
oldest continuously operating
Broadway theater. To be inside such a historical building and have our like rambunctious viral stan fans in that house is, I think, a really beautiful celebration of theater, the new with the old. So I think that aspect of it, too, has really brought the Be More Chill 3.0 experience to a whole nother level. I mean, when you're inside the theater, it's like there's so much history there, and our show also has a different kind of history, and to put those two together is insane.
Yeah. The house looks, it still looks old and it's maintained that way. And so, like, when you see the gray iPhone-looking structure that is our set, the actual difference, like, the shock value you get from that is so positive. I was afraid when I first saw the set design of how it was going to work in that theater, to be honest with you, because it is so modern. But it does really pay off that way. I don't think it would work as well in a more modern house, you know, like in the Sondheim or something like that.
It's also really cool to, when we first moved in, to see the reaction of some of the crew members who are like, you know, kind of residents of the Lyceum who are used to, you know, like The Visit. Or, you know what I mean?
Straight plays.
Yeah, a lot of plays, and so for them to kind of witness this, this really enthusiastic and energized response to a musical that's being housed in that space, it's like it was really quite enjoyable.
Yes, a lot of fluorescent colors. Yeah, that they're maybe
it
not
still
used
happens.
To seeing.
We still have guys being like, "What's a boyf?" backstage because they're still trying to catch up with the jokes in the musical. they're just running their show, you know.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Well, I was gonna say the show has gone through various incarnations at this point, and you made last year you made the transfer with some years in between from off Broadway in New Jersey to a major off Broadway theater, and now moving from that theater to Broadway. How have those? I mean, the three of you have been involved in the show forever, basically. How have the feel of those transitions sort of differed?
They're all very different. You know, when we did the run in New Jersey, you know, it's a theater. Two River Theater is a theater that's kind of really subscriber based, and so we had a lot of older audience members there. And you know, it sometimes you and I talked about this in a quick change booth last week. Like it oftentimes felt like we were doing the show for ourselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But also it was an experience for us to just try out this material that like we had fallen in love with, and this theater was lucky to give us this opportunity. So it like the pressure wasn't there. I mean, the pressure to like hopefully come to New York was there, but once we felt like that sort of was disappearing, then it became really about like, all right, let's just do this for us now and see what that is.
Yeah. And so like the audience, to have gone from that to 2 years of moving on to other projects and then to kind of pick this back up again, like our first performance off Broadway was bonkers. Like let's sidetrack real quick. We went to New Jersey to see to see the first regional production of Be More Chill.
Mm-hmm.
And they carted us in. They had us in a dressing room like we were the Clintons.
They hired security
for
us. We
had security guards. And they ushered us out like right before the show started. And then we watched these very talented people in New Jersey do our show.
And this was before Off-Broadway was announced.
Before Off-Broadway. This was before the conversation
was like the peak
about
sort of the musical becoming popular, right?
This yeah,
was like
yeah.
Around the time that it was starting to really rise.
Yeah, but this was before there was any kind of conversation or meeting with any producers about bringing it to New York. And like we were, it was. I remember like we all like. Were you in our car?
Or I was in the other car.
Okay, so in my car.
I was in the Brooklyn car.
The Brooklyn car.
Yeah.
The Brooklyn car that's fueled by corn.
And corn that I grew, George.
Yes. That you grew and brought in a
genetically modified
in a biodegradable tote bag.
In my brownstone apartment.
No, but I remember the car ride back. We were all, you know, there was like so much shouting and screaming and energy and love for the show. And we were in the car and it was just like. Like none of us were speaking. We were all kind of trying to process what had just happened. And so then fast forward to that first performance off Broadway, it was really overwhelming. I think all of us cried a little bit because this thing that the last time we had picked it up and done it for people was in New Jersey, you know, to like maybe 100 people.
Yeah.
And,
you know, it got panned a little bit and it just sort of like we thought – you know, we made the album and that's that. So, like, we have the album at least. Little did we know the album would be the thing, like, the catalyst to sort of propel the show to where it is now and help. I mean, George was also, like, huge in trying to get people to talk. Like, I remember you were telling me you talked to Joe a lot about, like, we should do something with this momentum. And, you know, it finally fired off something. And Jerry got involved somehow.
Yeah.
And Jerry Gehring really believed in the show and the promise of what the show could be for the kids and like the impact it's having on these kids. Like I said, to see it firsthand and to get these messages and meet these kids like that, it's like really, we are we are way more of an impact on their lives than I think we ever expected to be with this show. So that responsibility, along with how much love we felt that first day, it was truly Beatlemania. Like, that's the only way I could describe it. It was like Beatlemania.
Back to your question, too, I would say that, so the actors and the creative team, we have labeled Be More Chill 2 River 1.0, Off Broadway's 2.0, and Broadway's 3.0. And I would say that the experience, at least for me, 1.0 was kind of like, yeah, let's do this musical. Sure. That was fun. And then 2.0, you know, with the years in between and the whole viral sensation thing, because it was a limited engagement and we were experiencing the fans in person with us doing the show for the first time, it was like, oh my gosh, you came all the way from Brazil to see our off-Broadway production of Be More Chill? Okay. And I think when it came back to New York, there was clearly an energy in the room that was like curious about whether or not the show would continue. I mean, I think with the trajectory, it was like, what's going to happen next? Is something going to happen next? And in this run, in 3.0, I feel like for the first time, we have found such ownership of the show. We know what our show is. We know that it's crazy and weird. And, you know, we've opened. And the creatives are still orbiting, but it's really ours now. And I feel like a sense of play that I've never felt in any of the iterations. And a, like, nightly experience of just riding this wave. Mm-hmm. For the first time, it really feels like it's ours. And that's so special because it's so many years of hard work and questioning and this crazy trajectory that has finally led us to this place of just getting to share this story that we've made for everybody.
Mm-hmm. No, that it's interesting to think of, like, on the biggest stage, you somehow feel more free than before when you think there would be, like, more pressure than ever before, too.
Yeah. No, there doesn't seem to be, you're right, there doesn't seem to be, like, that kind of pressure anymore because I think we all, I know I can speak for myself, I never stopped believing in the show, so at every stage, there was this pressure of, like, we got to get this right because this thing has to continue on to the next step. There has to be a next step. And now we're kind of here and, like, what would be the next step? Like,
the next step, I think, is what we're doing. It's maintaining and playing.
Yeah,
and
totally.
That's, like, the best thing we can do. That's the whole fun of the show, too. It really allows us to do that. Not a lot of shows allow actors to do that, too. It's a lot of musicals I've done, you're sort of directed to do the exact same thing. And these songs and these scenes and the way it's written really allows us to have fun and help the show grow that way. And now it also feels like it is unbelievable the amount of influence it's had on the world at this point, but it feels less like intimidating pressure. It feels more just like, I know exactly what I'm doing with Rich Goransky every single night, and that's so exciting to, like, keep finding that and watch the kids really embrace, like, who otherwise would be known as sort of like a bully, sort of bad guy in a musical, like, they've found a way to craft this character, and we have, all of us, to make it somebody with just way more dimension. And that's the whole point of the musical. It's just like nothing is what it seems, and you sort of have to, like, discover your inner self to embrace your outer self. And these fans are amazing. They come dressed as, like, they're unicorns, straight up.
Yeah,
Stephanie quoted it
cosplay.
Perfectly. They are unicorns of fans. I've not seen anybody like any fans like this for any show.
Well, I was going to say that, I mean, I'm curious, you specifically have been in a couple shows with pretty rabid fan bases before, with Spring Awakening and American Idiot. And, I mean, is this just on a total other level even from those?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Spring Awakening is the closest thing to that, to this process, that I even feel like, even just the way the show is created over years and crafted with this cast, like with the same cast and brought off Broadway and then surprise on Broadway and all these people are rejoicing. But there wasn't cosplay and there wasn't, you know, Instagram and stuff like that.
So Victorian cosplay would have been interesting.
I was an avid Venla cosplayer, actually.
Could you imagine?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
I'm sure there's a photo of it somewhere. No, I really did dress up as Venla once.
Well, Spring Awakening really sent a radical movement of socks.
Yeah, it sure did. Those high socks.
I still rock the Spring Awakening
the high
socks.
Oh, my God.
It's probably because of Spring Awakening.
That's great. I love that. Look at that fashion trend in the 1800s.
What did you call it? rabid what?
A radical, radical movement?
Radical movement of socks.
It was a radical movement of socks.
I hate your NPR voice.
I love podcasts.
Yeah. I mean, it's just easier for fans to get in touch with you now, too. We can actually have relationships and friendships mm-hmm. with fans if we want to. It's literally that easy. Whereas there was sort of a barrier between us and the people who saw the show at Spring Awakening. And American Idiot was a little crazier just because Green Day fans were also coming to the show, like especially when Billy Joe was in it. I mean, there were days where Billy would have us like take the car with him after the show, and it's insane. People would like throw themselves onto the car as we're driving down 44th Street, like risking their lives to try and get a look at this guy. So that was insane. They had mm-hmm. to close down 44th Street a lot. But still, it's like the separation of viewer and performer was still there. Now it's just so easy to get to know these people if you want to and have an actual meaningful connection with them, which I think is great if you can handle that and you want to do that.
Well, I think also one of the most brilliant things that Bobby Tilley, our costume designer, did was that so many of the costume pieces are shopped. So you can literally Google neon green dress with pockets and yellow daisy, and you will find the dress that Christine wears. And so yeah. I've been like, why? How do these kids? Oh, Google, you know, like, and so it's so accessible in that way. And I think that's actually a part of the experience and the overall celebration of this show is that it is accessible in that way. And so they feel like they can participate in this journey, in this story, and also truly like embody these characters that they love so much.
They have like a sense of, they have this sense of ownership with the show because they are actually, in fact, quite responsible for yes. this show
yes.
having a life in New York City, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really cool to kind of, for us to have our ownership of the show and also to share that ownership with these people who use their voices loudly to demand more be more chill. More be more chill.
More be more. Well, I think that like one of the top amazing things about the show, about among many, is that it really has this like egalitarian feel. And despite the fact that like Jeremy is kind of the central character, he's not a traditional leading man, and it doesn't feel like there is a leading man and a leading lady, and it feels like you are all, everyone within the cast is a star in a way, and you three specifically each have like a big 11 o'clock number of sorts that doesn't happen at 11 o'clock, but and
God.
and I know that you know, since you've all been involved since the beginning, like I was curious, did you have traditional auditions? Were you always in mind for the parts that you ultimately got? How did you kind of become these characters in the first place?
Yeah, well, I will speak to the egalitarian nature of 3.0. And that was really intentional. Like we came into the creative room, the rehearsal room, and the creative team was like, something we're really interested in exploring for 3.0 is to, you know, share everybody's story in a little way, you know, that everyone has voices in their heads. Everyone is coming of age in some way, shape, or form in this version of Be More Chill. So that was really intentional and I think has served the story really well because, you know, no matter who you are or what age group you are in or who you were in high school, everyone can point to one person at least and be like, oh, I was probably a little bit of a Jenna, or I was like a Jenna Jake combo, or a Jenna Jake Christine, and then like behind closed doors was Jeremy, you know, like
it's like what we do with the cast of Friends.
That's the beauty of the trope, right? And I think that is also a testament to Ned Buzzini's book and these sort of types that exist that perpetuate themselves, and I think honoring that and sort of highlighting that makes space for people to feel included in the story. And in terms of the audition, I don't think I was certainly not considered for Jeremy. I sort of was always considered
spoiler.
For Christine. Spoiler alert, behind the scenes. I was always considered for Christine, and it was just a normal old audition. And at the time, I really wasn't doing quote unquote traditional musical theater. And so it was a really special meeting of the world, especially because Stephen Brackett did so much stuff with experimental theater and downtown stuff that our worlds really made sense together. Mm-hmm. So it's been like a, you know, wild, wild ride in that regard.
I also had a traditional audition, but when I read the breakdown, it was like one of those times where you're like, oh my God, I've never seen a role that's like more perfect. Like, it was one of those things where if I don't book this job, I'm quitting acting forever because it's like me. It's me on paper.
Healthy.
It was just my drive to get it. And also I knew I was familiar with Joe, and I had not worked with Joe Iconis yet, and I really, really wanted to. I missed a few opportunities to audition for the Black Suits back in the day that I was kicking myself for like years. And so when this came up, I was like, I can't miss another opportunity to work with this guy. And I remember Stephen Brackett in the audition made me feel so good as soon as I walked in, because I hate auditioning. It gives me a lot of anxiety. And with that part, I made sure I was off book. I knew exactly everything I wanted to do. And Brackett got up from behind the table, which people don't usually do in audition rooms. They usually sit there and just like tell you to do your thing. He got up, he shook my hand, and he thanked me for my time, for being there before I even did anything. And I just thought it was so like welcoming and warm, and it seemed very genuine, and it like invited me to just do my best work.
It's like the most warm, fuzzy audition behavior ever.
It was so simple too. It's like it wasn't too much. It was just like, dude, thank you so much for being here. Like, let's do this. You ready? Have any questions? I was like, what? Nah, man, let's rock and roll. Like, I'm ready. And I think I threw a chair at one point in the audition, like when I was bullying Jeremy, you know, quote unquote. And like in any other audition, I don't think I would have like gusto to do something like that. I would like second guess that thing. But for some reason, I was just like, fuck it, man. I got time. I can just do this. I can just do it. Thank you for making me feel like I could just do anything in the room. Oh, my God. I hope I work with you guys. And lo and behold, yeah, got to do the reading and Two River. It was like truly amazing. It was like secreting my this job into the world. So
I auditioned for a Black Suits production, the one in LA, and I didn't get it. And Joe was like, oh, I'm so sorry, man, you were so great, but it just didn't work out. But he was like, I'm writing this other show that I think you're perfect for, so keep your eyes peeled, because we're gonna do a reading of it in the spring. This was back in 2013, and then in the spring of 2014, I got an email, and at the time, Scott Ellis was the director. So Jen Tepper and I joke about how if Scott Ellis had remained on board, we might be in the marquee, not the Lyceum. So I did that reading, and then when Stephen Brackett came on board, I had left New York. I was done with musical theater. Like, I was done with theater. I was like hungry for something different.
Why do we all have those thoughts?
Well, because the business is tough. But like, I was searching for something, and I didn't know what it was. And I just went out to Los Angeles to see if maybe I could find that there. And got a call from Joe Iconis that Stephen Brackett, who was not familiar with me, wanted me to put an audition on tape and send it in. So I did that and booked the show and moved back to New York. And in the process of doing Be More Chill in New Jersey, I realized that the thing that I was like, that I left New York looking for was like right here with this show. Mm. And so in so many ways, you know, when I talk about Be More Chill, I get really overwhelmed emotionally. Like, I've been known to cry a lot when I talk about this show, and it's because like this thing that I left the city looking for was here in those pages and in the music and in all of these characters and in the amazing actors that we've got to share this show with. From 1.0 into 2.0 and now 3.0. So I never booked a musical off of a self tape before. Mm-hmm. It was nice of Stephen Brackett to say, okay, fine.
I'm sure he said more than okay, fine, but yeah.
I have to say, that's actually, I've never really heard that story articulated that way before. And I...
Because I'm usually crying when I'm saying it.
But I really relate to that because I also I was going to move to L.A. like 100 times. I was going to move to L.A. and then SpongeBob happened. And then I was like, okay, I'm on a 6-month contract. Like, I'm going to drive across the country over the summer and then I'm going to, you know, move to L.A. and like be an actor there but also like have a farm. And then and then I found out that we were, that Be More Chill was happening off Broadway. And I was like, okay, so I'm just going to stay until September. And then, like, if nothing happens, I'm just going to drive across the country and move to LA and have a farm and do acting there. And then Broadway happened. And I'm so relieved because I feel like this experience, I mean, I know that this experience and the trajectory of the show, this show, no matter how long it runs, is we've changed the infrastructure of theater in some way. Like, this mm-hmm. will go down in the history of theater, and that is remarkable. And to be able, you know, Stephen Brackett, the show itself is so special, but Stephen Brackett as a collaborator and as a director infuses his rehearsal process with such intention of love and joy that the reason why it feels like hours right now is because he gave us permission to truly play. And for us to, you know, it's a cast of 10. It's all principal actors. For all of us to be able to play and shine in that way and also have such a fan following and to have access to different platforms to speak to the changes we want to see in the world that are mm-hmm. so related to the heart of our show, that is a dream come true for an artist. Yeah. Is to not only do something that you love, but to be able to like speak to the things and the ways in which you want to participate in the world at large. That's like a dream, and I cannot even believe that it happened with our show that we first did at Two River Theater, which is an amazing theater, but like none of us could have imagined this. So yeah, I just really relate to what you're speaking of, George, and when I think about it, when I really allow myself to sit with it, I recognize the ways in which this show has completely changed my life and the trajectory of my own growth as a person, as an artist, as a human in this world. It's really, I feel so much gratitude and like humbleness by the cosmos.
No, yeah, I see a notable change in all of us. Yeah. And this sounds, this might sound really corny, but I see a huge shift in everyone's and how we all carry ourselves and what we find to be most important. And like, it's a really crazy thing to consider the possibility that like our art can impact us as the artists.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
I was going to say it. I mean, with everything from the way the process is approached to the diversity of the casting to the kind of roles you're playing, period, it just seems like the kind of show after which you look at your career and what you, the expectations you set for yourself in a different way in terms of what is possible.
Yes.
Well, it's a huge milestone. I mean, this is unlike anything I've ever done. This is the artist's literal dream. I mean, this is what we try to do. You try to work on something that you can infuse all of your passion with and not be stifled creatively. Mm-hmm. And then not only that, that translates to the world and the world is appreciating it and embracing it and celebrating it. And then like Stephanie said, we have these platforms now to help influence younger people. But I got news for you, man. These younger people are influencing me. Mm-hmm. They are so much more woke than I was when I was like 12, 14. Like, forget about it. I don't even know. Like, I'm learning so much now from these kids and from the kid that I'm playing every night. It's pretty mind-blowing. So I'm like, it's going to be pretty hard to top this.
Yes.
I've said that a few times in my career, but it's going to be really hard to top this.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you.
And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Well, I mentioned before you, each of you has kind of a huge number, and I felt like talking about them a little bit would be a good way to into sort of what makes Joe's music so great, because I think they all showcase very different sides of him as a composer.
Yeah.
So we could start, Gerard, with you, and okay. It's from Japan.
Well, Squip Song to me is the song that I've always been waiting to sing, and I never knew it. It reminds me a lot of like my favorite sort of like modern patter pop, you know, musical theater songs, like mm-hmm. Like that a Norbert Leo Butz would perform. That's what I thought when mm-hmm. I first got sent the MIDI file. Like, it was just Joe's voice and like a keyboard teaching me the Squip Song with the, you know, I had the sheet music, but it was also Joe like freely singing like Joe. And so I heard that, saw the music. I was like, okay, I get it. This is like this weird, like loose. I didn't know it was like funky and sexy because that's not the arrangement I had when I first heard the song. All I knew was that it was a story. And I got down with that because I love a story song. And yeah, it just flows and it rocks. And then once we started working on the song, once I got the part, I got to start to sort of play with it. Play with the structure of it a little bit, play with the riffing and the screaming and the stuff like that. It's from Japan was a total just like I was goofing off in rehearsal one day and Joe liked it. And I came back to rehearsal the next day and it was in print. So now it's in the musical.
Excellent, excellent edition.
But that's how it's created, right? That's like it was such a casual, loose thing, but that's sometimes how the best art is made. It's like just a natural inclination to do something. And the song itself, it's like it's weird, it's perverse, it's sexy and disturbing and celebratory at the same time. I've literally never in my life gotten to sing a song like it.
It's all the things.
Yeah, it is. It really is. But the story, the central focus of the storytelling is really what drew me to Joe, because that guy can write a story song like nobody else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think my favorite part of rehearsals in general is when Joe overnight writes a song and comes yeah. in with something extraordinary. And I remember, this isn't a song that I sing because I don't play Jeremy here, yeah. But that was like French was and French-ish. Also Frenchish. Anyway, I was just trying to do the guttural sounds that you've asked me to do because I like to take the note. I remember when Joe came in with Loser Geek Whatever, and I was literally like, yo, last night I like didn't even take a shower. You like yeah. came in with a whole new song? This is crazy. And one of my favorite lyrics in the whole show and 3.0 and this now Broadway version is in Loser Geek Whatever. That's a Loser Geek Whatever. The lyric, whoa, Like, I think that Joe is I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think he is a poet of the conversational nature of words.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is so spectacular. You know, I don't know what goes on in other people's subconscious, but it is not ever as articulate as rhymey as some musical theater songs. And I think that is such a strength of Joe's, is to find music and melody in the ways in which our minds wander.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that about his music because it's so real. So that's one of my favorite lyrics of
especially
of
play rehearsal. I mean, that like letting your mind wander thing.
yeah.
What song is like that? I mean, I'm sorry.
It's yeah. like just anything going through your brain at the time. It is
ADD on stage. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Completely.
And I also remember when he came in with Guy That I'd Kind of Be Into Too.
Mm-hmm.
Guy That I'd Kind of Be Into Too. At Two River, it was also like a similar experience where one day we were about to go into tech and he just brought in that song. And I think another testament to Joe Iconis and his artistry and his care is that it is collaborative to him. He knows and trusts and likes to embrace the people that he's working with and write for them. And I think that is so special and so loving, you know. I mean, the biggest gift, one of the biggest gifts you can be given is to be a part of someone's baby and for them to give you one of theirs, you know, for you. I don't know if I meant babies. Maybe I just
I would give you my baby.
You can
give me your baby?
Yeah.
No, thanks, George.
I gotta get one, but
I think you can just buy one at Duane Reade. Isn't that how that works? Why don't you tell us about Michael in the bathroom, George?
No, I wanted to speak on the trusting nature and the collaborative vibe that Joe works with. It's like he is not precious with mm-hmm. his work. So if you the perfect example is we did this we did a series of concerts together called Two Player Game, and I he myself and Jen Tepper curated this laundry list of Iconis songs, and when we went into the studio to record the album, I was like looking at a lyric sheet and was like, Joe, I have not been singing those words. And he was like, yeah. And I was like, why didn't you say anything? He was like, because this is your version of the song. He was like, this is the George Salazar version of that song. And that's the word. And I'm not saying like I paraphrase the entire lyric, but like mm-hmm. there was like, instead of the, I said And, you know, there's a freedom that he mm-hmm. Allots us. And it has everything to do with that playful ownership thing that we feel now. Yeah. All of our collaborators on this show kind of carried that same vibe. But, you know, with Michael in the Bathroom, we had that 2014 workshop with Scott Ellis, and Joe sat at the piano. They let everyone else go, and we sang through it, and it used to be really low. In my voice, at least. And I felt uncomfortable with how low it felt because I felt like it didn't pack a punch in that mm-hmm. register of my voice. And so we tried it up a half step, and then we tried it up another half step. And this key that Joe had originally written it in is no longer the key, and it is now like a much higher and much more difficult and terrifying key to sing every night. But he's... he's allowed me, Stephanie, Gerard, Will, Jason Tam, Jason Sweet, all of us. He's allowed all of us to find a way to make these songs our own mm-hmm. In a way that allows our performances of them to feel more authentic to the audience, which I think allows the songs and the characters to be way more relatable to the audiences mm-hmm. as well, you know?
It's almost like it's the trust factor is huge with him. He just trusts the people he works with, which not a lot of people do. It's like trust is actually very hard to find in this industry, especially with creative teams, especially with writers. I mean, most writers are extremely precious about their work, even us and thes and its and, you know. Mm-hmm. Joe almost takes risks in a way, like by trusting every single artist, musicians too, because I've played with him quite a bunch as a percussionist and guitar player, and he'll send you what he has, but he just assumes, like, you're a musician, you'll figure it out. You'll do your job, I'll do my job, and it's going to be great. Mm-hmm. That is seriously lacking in this industry these days. And so I feel like that trust is why the Joe Iconis family is so large, because every creative soul that I know and respect wants to work with him. Mm-hmm. And, like, that just starts with trust.
Yeah.
Baseline.
That's pretty rare.
Yeah.
But I will also say, though, because I think we all like to be like, yeah, it's like, so whatever. He'll also put his foot down in like a beautiful way.
For
like,
sure.
I think that is the beautiful balance of being able to send someone off to play. And then also if something is going in a different direction or not exactly what it's supposed to be, he'll still be a part of that editing process. And I think that is, he's still like so very yeah. intentional with what he's building.
Good edit.
Well, going back to play rehearsal for a moment,
yeah.
I mean, I think that when you perform the song within the context of the show is, I mean, it's people laugh because your performance is hilariously delightful. But I also just get the sense that there are a lot of people in the audience who kind of know what you're talking about. And like we all have had a moment when we really liked Play Rehearsal. So I was curious, were the three of you drama club people in high school? And like what were, you know, Christine is very into playing Juliet, among other roles. What were your kind of like Vanguard roles back then?
Ooh, Vanguard. I did Once on This Island as a freshman in high school. It was very inappropriate.
Yes. Sigh. Wow. Sigh.
Yeah, heavy wow. Sigh. No, I had zero Vanguard high school, but I did the cool thing about my
You were on Broadway in high school.
Yeah, girl, I know. But like high school theater, regional stuff, like, or whatever, I got to do something cool for my high school, though, because the actual theater program in my high school was something completely different than it was when I left. My drama teacher slash music teacher lost actually left her job. She had kids, and so she used to do the play every year. Then they hired a woman to do it for free, and she was sort of taking over the play and whatever. When I came in, I didn't really like this woman. She didn't really treat me with respect. I think she hated the fact that I was very young and on Broadway already, and she had like one Broadway credit. It was like a lot of jealousy, and I was like, I'm 14.
She was Mrs. Reyes.
Literally, she was Mrs. Reyes. But I got through
That's
a course of
a
year or two, we had her. She was eventually let go, and we had my favorite teacher, the drama person, become the head of the play every year. And we started with maybe five kids, creating a little thing called the Seraph Players, and now it's like 50 or 60 kids strong.
Wow.
Since I graduated years ago. But it's great. It's like amazing. I'm so glad I got to do that for my high school because, yes, I was working on Broadway, but like in high school, the theater club, those were my people. That's where I could be myself. I wasn't a jock. I was respected, but I wasn't like into that, you know, I wasn't into sports or anything like that.
Stephanie and I were jocks.
We were. My freshman year, I played basketball and I was obsessed with Muggsy Bogues because he was 5'1 and I'm 4'11 and 3'4.
Perfect.
I was an incredible perimeter shooter, like, you know, loved the Lakers, grew up in California. And I just never really wanted to do theater. I was always like, I don't want to be a theater nerd. And people kept being like, just do it. Just do it. And I was like, fine. I kind of like it.
You got peer pressured into going to the theater. I love that.
This is a crazy story. My friend who is such a huge reason as to like why I do theater now, I've known him since kindergarten. He scheduled me a quote unquote audition for Drama One Advance, which was basically like Drama One, but you just audition for it. And I canceled on the audition because I was like, I don't want to do that. And he scheduled me, come on now. He talked to the teacher and like rebooked me for another audition outside of the audition time. And we like did it in the quad and I sang something from Little Mermaid because I knew nothing about musical theater. And that was like the beginning of my experience of theater. And all throughout high school, I just kind of was like, yeah, plays are cool. And people would be like, you should go to college for this. And I'd be like, how is that even a thing that you can like study acting? But so it was just a bunch of beautiful like guardian angels. And when my senior year, I was like, you know, involved. And we did Noises Off and I played Dottie and that was really special. And my mom asked me, I had like wrinkle lines that I drew in with, you know, eyeliner. My mom asked me why I always play the ugly people. cool. And
mom,
I feel like, well, she was, you know, anyway, we were all doing our best. I also played Mrs. Mears, which is also truly screwed up, but we don't have to unpack that now. But I was great. But I feel like actually I am more Christine Canigula than I've ever been in my life. I think that she has taught me so much about what it means to just truly love the thing that you do. And I was so ashamed for so long to be an actor because I just didn't understand the true impact of art and performing arts. Like I just couldn't conceive or perceive that possibility and reality. And through this show, and she has really taught me that. And
I feel like the theater that I see around me right now, I mean, it's just been, it's such an exciting Broadway season. Like, there's just so much amazing work being done right now. And I feel as passionately about it as Christine does, you know?
There's like a lot of young, attractive people on Broadway right now. I'm just gonna throw it out there.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's exciting.
I'm neither young nor attractive.
That's not true.
My Vanguard role in high school.
Let's hear it.
Was Venla.
I was Venla in front of my full length mirror. I kind of similarly to Stephanie, but also the opposite. I was not a jock. I did not play basketball. I was quite the slob, and my routine was typically go home from school, Totino's pizza rolls. You guys know
those?
I knew
you were going to talk about a snack. Yeah. I could tell where your eyes went. You can't see his eyes, but they were snack eyes.
They cross a little bit.
They
cross and I stopped blinking. No, Totino's pizza rolls, like a 40-pack bag, like the ones that in the commercials the moms serve to a party of like 11 teenagers. I housed the entire bag myself. Yeah. I would eat those, and I didn't even put them in the oven to make them properly. I just threw them in the microwave.
George.
Because I had zero standards, and I would watch Maury Povich.
Oh my God.
That was my typical.
I loved Maury.
Me too.
You are the father. That was my typical routine.
Part of me is sad, and part of me feels like this is maybe living your best life.
This is the glow up. Is that from a yes. couch with Totino's pizza rolls to talking about it at the Billboard offices? And so one day, I was a huge Weird Al fan, and I would rewrite pop songs, but they were not safe for work, not safe for school, not safe for anywhere, really. They were so offensive, and
so
I
unusual.
Would sing these songs for my classmates, and I did it one day during I was an IB program kid, so like we were taking a class called Information Technology in a Global Society, which was literally it was just
very Y2K.
Make PowerPoint presentations. Like that was the curriculum.
Yeah.
And I sang one of these songs. I think it was a parody of "Baby Hit Me Baby One More Time" by Britney Spears, and the drama club president skipped school a lot and was a year ahead of us, but had to take this class with us, and overheard me singing, came up to me and was like, "You should audition for the school musical tonight." And I was like, "No, I have plans." But it was just to eat Totino's pizza rolls and watch Maury Povich. So eventually he dragged me in. I similarly did not know any musical theater, didn't even know that musicals existed, truly.
Yeah.
Like growing up mixed race in Florida, like we didn't watch musicals. I didn't know the musicals were a thing. Like
totally.
My parents were fully grooming me to become a doctor, which is why I was taking information technology in a global society. And so
preparing you for Instagram.
Can we cut that statement out? So I went in and he was like, this is called an audition. Like he was like walking me through these things like I was a foreign exchange student. And I sang the Elton John version of Circle of Life from The Lion King, and then they cast me as Seymour Krelborn in a production of Little Shop of Horrors that I'm still like hugely proud of. It was, I had an African-American Audrey. Each Ronette was of a different ethnicity. It was truly a groundbreaking high school production of Little Shop.
That's very cool.
Before anyone in New York was doing any kind of colorblind casting.
Well, I want to see you as Seymour now.
Oh. I'll have to find the video. I was in glasses and I weighed 250 pounds. So you really do want to watch this video.
Yeah.
I'm sure as my mom shakily zoomed in on my face, you could see pizza sauce on the corner of my mouth from the Totino's pizza rolls.
Wow.
But Little Shop of Horrors, Seymour Krelborn, Vanguard.
I feel like you're going to get a lot of special stage door gifts after this podcast. And they will be pizza
rolls. Swimming in pizza rolls.
Yes.
At the Lyceum.
Not a bad
just
gift.
Put them in a plastic bin so the rats don't come, George. Don't forget.
Stephanie Hsu, first day of of being in the lyceum was like, can we have plastic bins because the rats?
No, it was a huge problem at SpongeBob.
Oh, that's where the bins came from?
I was really traumatized.
But I haven't seen, any mouse anything.
Uh-uh. Knock on...
Yeah, that you're
knock
right.
on wood, but let me tell you, I saw rats eat through people's refrigerators when we were doing SpongeBob SquarePants in the school.
Wow.
Dang.
On that happy note,
I went through your refrigerator.
It's only juice.
I could talk to you people all day, but I want to end the podcast on a very deep note. Stephanie has answered this question once, iconically. I want to ask you about your personal squips. They can be things. They can be people. Last time she was here, Stephanie memorably said her squip was a tree.
Still true. I have people now, though.
Okay. I was just wondering. We can start with you. Is your squip still a tree?
And absolutely.
Expand.
In fact, actually, my friend and I, who make medicinal healing salves, we just hired our
which
friends.
Which are amazing, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you. So we just hired our friends to build these raised beds in her garden. And we planted seeds a few weeks ago, but it's been kind of cold. And I was just – and it's kind of shady. And so I've been really – kind of worried if the seeds would sprout at all. And just yesterday, the seeds sprouted through the soil. And I was like, oh, I am so humbled by the lessons of nature and what they teach me about time and the right conditions to grow. So yes, that is still a tree, and all things that grow through the ground are still my squip. However, I also love Jada Pinkett Smith. She has Red Table Talk, and I'm obsessed with it. It's like my favorite. I don't even have Facebook, but you can still watch Facebook when you have a computer, and you can Google it and do the Facebook Live watch.
Thank you. Thank you, Danish child, for finishing her answer.
But I am obsessed with that show, and I think Jada Pinkett Smith for sure is my squip. The way she talks about truth and like standing up for what you believe in, and her bringing together three generations of women to have really difficult conversations, all with such joy, and she looks so fly all the time. I'm just like, oh, you're my squip. I get it. What a squip is.
I'm laughing in part because I know what you mean. And she also, watching Will Smith's Instagram, she shades him so magnificently. It's really, Jada's great.
Yeah, she's great.
That's an awesome choice.
Thank you.
Wow.
I did a lot of research for you because I was like, I've got to come up with something other than a tree.
But you do.
I love that tree metaphor, though. That's great.
And you have a very plant-centric Instagram as well.
Well,
she puts her money where her mouth is.
Take IB technology for the future. Like George.
That's the problem with public schools, baby.
I know, true.
I mean, I did go to a public school.
Me too.
I did not, unfortunately.
We had, do you guys remember those projectors with the clear things and you could draw on them with markers?
Yeah. Should
and
we
also
buy one?
Shadows?
We definitely should buy one for the theater.
Yeah, you can.
Oh, okay. Well,
just for funsies. Anyway, squips.
I have said this from the beginning, but my squip would be Danny DeVito as Frank Reynolds in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Here's the thing about that show. That show, those characters are jerks. Like, they're bad people. And you shouldn't, like, people shouldn't enjoy watching shows about bad people. Like, you shouldn't want to root for bad people, but there's just something about their energy together as an ensemble. Anyway, I would love to have – there's one episode of It's Always Sunny called Being Frank Reynolds, and it's entirely shot in first-person view. So it's shot as Danny DeVito in first person.
Oh, my God.
So it's like – it's about 4'5". And there's like this – like there's a crazy moment where he just like goes into his bathroom and he's like, pills, got to find the pills, got to find the pills. And he's like going through a medicine cabinet, takes pills. It starts hallucinating. Anyway, that episode, I watched it and I was like, okay, if I could, it would probably only be funny for a day, but if I could have that little voice in my head being like telling me not how to be cool, not instructing me on the right things to do, but telling me like all of the disastrous things that I could do in any given moment, it would be A, hilarious, but B, a true test of my own wherewithal to like block that voice out of my head and just continue to do what I'm doing. Yeah, but basically asking for a Danny DeVito podcast.
Yes, that good.
That is a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week bonanza.
Whatever works, George.
Yeah.
And he gets to sing the Troll Toll song, which is hilarious.
Yes.
No one
yes.
did.
Thank you for knowing that.
I have to credit
his
my boyfriend,
Instagram
who
posts
is
are full of the Troll Toll.
It's Always Sunny obsessive.
You know,
but
that he'll
be very happy to hear this.
You know, they toured the country performing The Night Man Cometh.
I was not aware of that.
So
now I'm sad I haven't seen it.
They wrote this musical that is an entire episode of the show, and they went around the country promoting it and performing it at like colleges. And there's videos of it online. It is something else.
I'm excited.
I'm going to make you watch it.
It's a lot.
I'm going to duct tape you to a chair.
Yes.
You guys had such funny and good stories. Mine has also been the same. It's Robert Downey Jr. Hilariously, after I said that, a friend of mine sent me a huge cardboard cutout of Robert Downey Jr. to my dressing room. So now he exists behind
Amazing.
My door. I find that his journey through like his life and his career has been troublesome, and he's made a lot of mistakes, and he's also rectified those mistakes and then came out with like this Avengers like franchise essentially that he's now like an executive producer on as well as an actor on. And like he sort of like rebuilt his image from like a negative place and did it so successfully that like I will listen to anything that man now has to say because he's been through it. He's seen some things and hopefully has changed for the better.
That was concise and delightful.
Wait, who's your squib?
Yeah, who's yours?
Oh, my God. I'm unprepared.
It's okay.
It's
Danny DeVito.
It's Danny DeVito. Who is my squib? I don't know. My most recent squib. Okay. I feel like you'll appreciate this, Stephanie.
Okay, great.
I started watching the most recent Attenborough nature documentary series on Netflix. I'm very,
been
very into Blue Planet this past year.
Wow.
Now into Our Planet, and I witnessed like a baby flamingo walking, and it was just everything. So
Girl.
I'll say my squib is a baby flamingo.
We should hang out.
Can I make a suggestion? I have Philips Hue bulbs in my bedroom and in my living room. And there's an app called Hue Camera that you can use you put your phone on a tripod and you film your television screen. And the best way to watch any of those nature docs is with that app, because then all of the lights around you change with the scenery that you're watching on TV. It's like, I feel like I'm at Disney. Like I'm at Epcot and
I've seen those bulbs before, and I know what you mean.
Do it.
So yeah, it's a new application. Okay,
sorry.
Pink for flamingos, except the baby flamingos are not pink yet.
What? Wait,
because they haven't eaten
enough
shrimps.
They're like gray, right?
They're gray.
They're like shrimps.
They're gray and very, like very ugly and very awkward and like just imagine something walking like a flamingo, but in like total miniature and like really fluffy.
Oh.
Which is also such a lesson in growth and blooming, everybody.
Exactly. Yes.
Thank
they persist.
You for listening.
The baby flamingos persist.
Thank you for listening.
For this episode of Billboard Flamingos.
I think Stephanie Hsu needs a podcast.
She does,
yes. Well, maybe that's the next iteration of this. I was going to say, isn't Be More Chill 4.0 like maybe a movie? Maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah, they've announced it.
They have. Yeah. They have.
Greg Berlanti is, we met him. He came to see the show and he's the sweetest, nicest man. They're going to develop it into a film. And we're all going to be in our 50s, so we won't be able to be in it.
We're all going
to
play Mr. Reyes at one scene or another. That's what it'll be. No, it's great. I'm so glad, man. It was announced like before we even started performing, right?
Yeah, Joe and I were in San Francisco doing our concerts, and he had just taken a flight from meeting with Greg to San Francisco. And like 4 minutes after he told me how the meeting went, it leaked on Deadline, and people were already talking
That's crazy.
About this movie. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, I hope it happens maybe like around the same time the In the Heights movie that I've been hearing about for like a decade happens. Yeah. Then we'll just have lots of musicals at once. And I'm going to close by saying I just saw Gerard's tattoo that says Love Wins, and I thought it said Love Wines.
Oh, God.
Wow, that shows up where your brain is at.
Well,
and
I do love wine,
and with that,
but
I close the podcast.
From a guy that you'd never be into a guy that you'd kind of be into, from a guy that I'd never be into a guy that I'd kind of be into, is he worth it? Jeremy, is he?
Be More Chill is playing at the Lyceum Theater, and the original Broadway cast recording will be released on Ghostlight Records later this spring. If you're a fan of the podcast, you can find Billboard on Broadway on iTunes. Please subscribe, maybe leave a nice review and some stars. You can also find us on Spotify, Google Play, and Stitcher, among other platforms. On social media, I am on Twitter at Rebecca Milzoff, on Instagram at YaDownWithRMM. You can always tweet or talk about the podcast with hashtag Billboard on Broadway, and hope to have you back next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.